Welcome to episode 9 of the N3SP podcast, a production of the National Security Strategic Studies Partnership, or N3SP. Our guest today is Major Melissa McLean. She's a research fellow at the Institute for Future Conflict at the U.S. Air Force Academy and is a 2009 graduate of the Academy, after which time she became an intel officer on active duty. She has experience creating war games with the Blue Horizon Fellowship and later parlayed that into an assignment where she was asked to stand up an emerging technology office, which that led to her interest in artificial intelligence, which will be the focus of our conversation today. As with all episodes, the opinions and ideas of the speakers do not necessarily reflect the positions of any government organization, academic institution, or commercial entity, and should not be construed to do so. So with that as a brief introduction, welcome, Melissa.
Thank you, Darren.
So we talked a little bit before, as I usually do, to get a sense of where our conversation ought to go. And you've got a wide variety of topics you've covered in your career thus far. And if you go off for your PhD soon, sounds like you'd be doing much more along those lines. So to figure out what we can talk reasonably about in this period of time, I wanted to pick up on your work related to teaming with artificial intelligence systems and how you work out how people can best make use of AI as a tool, because that's a thing that, as we discussed earlier on the side, you're trying to connect different worlds, right? So, you know, from technology to the human side, in this case, with regard to AI. So could you start with, knowing that we may have a variety of listeners coming to this from students to practitioners and professionals, can you start off with a good overall introduction to what the challenge of human AI teaming is, and then how you start to work on that problem? So what would your basic instruction to the people
be? Yes. That's a great question. So one of the things that we often forget being humans is that we all bring our past experiences and expectations to the table when we try to solve a problem. And those take the form of a mental model, or also could be called a cognitive schema for those folks that are more psychology oriented. That mental model really drives how we understand the problem. Even if someone's up there presenting the problem from a different perspective, potentially challenging our existing mental model, we will often, you know, disregard information that presents to oppose our mental model. So if we start to unpack this problem in regards to human agent teaming, or HAT, which includes humans teaming with AI-enabled agents as well. There's many different buzzwords, but for the purposes of this, we'll stick with HAT as a simple term for human agent teaming. Essentially, those underlying mental models drive the way we develop those AI agents. And oftentimes, those models are not prioritizing teaming for the AI agent to actually be able to be a teammate.
So if I stop you there, not prioritizing teaming, that means it's being developed purely to address a problem per inputs. It's not, and the input would be the package of data that the software's got to work with, and it's not asking for or connecting with a human in the process of that. It simply spits out an answer when it's done. Is that sort of what you're saying there?
Yes. So in the execution phase, which one of the other big parts of this problem state and unpacking it, is really to realize that a lot can happen before execution or after execution to improve the teaming between the human and the AI, both in design phase and then in actual operational employment. But for this case, we have to be aware in the design phase that, you know, the AI needs to have feedback loops. It needs to have sensors to be able to sense in some semblance, what is the human doing, or how is the human responding to what I'm doing? In much the same way, you know, the model of human-to-human teaming is actually something that I talk about, and it gets us askew and really down the road of, we want this thing to be trustworthy, right? That's a big term when we think about AI right now and see the different pieces coming out in the press and policy wise, but how do we get to trustworthy is one of my questions. And what is a stepping stone approach that might get us there by designing AI to be a teammate early on?
So what would you say is the set of criteria which define trustworthiness?
So there's actually a NIST scale that, if I'm remembering correctly, it has 10 different aspects like reliability, transparency, things like that, many illities that compose trustworthiness. So somebody's done the good legwork on that trustworthiness. But from what distilling down various research, what I've found is that we can actually simplify it even further so that we could write contracts, right? We have to be able to write contracts to design these systems. If we're able to make AI observable, predictable, and then directable, those are the three stepping stones that I'd propose. And it's built off of Matt Johnson. He is down in Florida doing this research. And that is his model that he proposes to tease out what he calls joint activity and to find those interdependencies between the human and the AI agent.
Let's pick up with the idea of mental models and how you might put some of these into actual practice, because I think that will help people start to understand what you're talking about here. But before we do that, you mentioned, I think, NIST. Is that NIST, National Institute for Standards, has that list? So if anyone's interested and they want the full 10 aspects of trustworthiness, they can go and, you know, do a search that involves the National Institute of Standards and those terms, and they can get it. And if I find it, I might add that as a note.
Yeah, there's 7, so I could read them 7? Off if you want. They've updated them since the one report that I read. So
those 7 would be what?
So they bundle them. Validity and reliability are considered 1. Safety, security, and resiliency are considered a couple. Accountability and transparency are also a couple. Explainability and interpretability, another couple. Privacy, and then the 7th is fairness with mitigation of harmful bias.
Okay, so those are 7, but they're a very loaded 7. So they've reduced the number, but they packed a lot in there, which I think is very characteristic of this whole topic, right? There's a lot packed into this. So again, coming back to helping people understand your work and this emerging field as it stands now, pick it up from there about some of the models you're using.
Okay, so all of our mental models are based on what I refer to as, in this case, formative AI experiences. So if we think of, right, when we're using Netflix, a lot of us aren't even aware of the amount of AI and just the algorithms running in the background to understand, you know, what are our user preferences? Do we have different moods? If we watch shows at different times of day, does that drive a certain style? Maybe we like comedy in the mid-afternoon, but in the evening we watch action movies. Netflix knows all this in their algorithms based on all the data they're pulling. So essentially, we're very used to AI operating in the background, all these algorithms when I talk to AI. And it's interesting working with cadets. Many of the cadets talk about being known by the AI, which for my generation, you know, I'm 36 years old, that sounds quite terrifying about being known by the AI. But to them, they find comfort in that. So that's an example of a formative AI experience where the AI is in the background, it's doing all this stuff, it's providing convenience for the user, and it's just a seamless experience. Oftentimes very personalized experience. Another example of a AI experience that has really shaped a lot of people's perception of AI as of late is just their experience with ChatGPT. This is one where, you know, folks might argue that this is a teaming relationship, but in reality, you provide the input, there's an output, there's really limited teaming during that execution phase, and those feedback loops aren't existent. So what does this drive as far as our mental models? So we could come to the table with, you know, okay, this AI teammate needs to be just like a human, right? The false implied assumption there is that the AI agent is going to perform all of the functions of a human, including our cognitive abilities. Right now, the status of the technology is very narrow in scope. Even with the natural language processing capability, it's still accomplishing narrowly scoped tasks versus that more general that would be required for it to act and behave as we would expect a human teammate. This false implied assumption drives a fear that AI is going to replace humans. And that leads us down the road, which often when I brief various folks about this topic, we start down the road of singularity.
Kurzweil.
So essentially, I will never trust the AI, right? Because I do not want to be replaced. So that is an underlying fear within that mental model that often exposes itself. So, there's two more mental models if you want me to share those as well.
Well, let's pick up on those in a second, but let me follow up with a question here and interrupt if I may with that replace humans piece. As I understand it from, you know, what you've been talking about here, you're not talking about replacing humans on the cognition side. You're really talking about in the teaming, replacing certain human functions or parsing out certain, peeling off certain human functions so the AI can work on them and then sort of report back to the human agent to decide what to do with that information and then make a decision and then send the AI on to another task so that you're kind of enhancing human cognition by offloading some tasks. It's a data crunching task, right? So the analogy I remember beginning of the academic year when ChatGPT started to roll out, the Academy had an all-faculty discussion about, well, how do we deal with this in terms of teaching and assignments and the like? And one of the more interesting analogies I heard used was, well, this is kind of like grappling with the introduction of calculators, right? So you had a point where there was a transition from the slide rule, all human interaction with the tool, the slide rule, to calculators. And there was concern that people would lose certain capabilities and they wouldn't be thinking as well if they weren't using the slide rule to calculate their numbers using logarithms. They were just punching numbers into a calculator. But on the other hand, coming from an engineering background myself, I never thought that I was shortchanged because I didn't use a slide rule. It might have taught me a few things more about logarithms than I appreciated in the math classes I had. But any device like that allows you to focus on solving the problem as opposed to necessarily doing the math. Now, mathematicians may cringe at that because they're all about the math. And you certainly need to understand the math so you can check it, right? I mean, a calculator, trustworthiness, a calculator, if it's trustworthy, you put in 2 + 2, it's going to give you 4 every single time. If it gives you 5 one time out of 20, you're not going to trust it. So, with regard to AI, how do you think the analogy to a calculator in terms of offloading, two aspects to that? One, is it accurate to say that this is in a human-machine pair, a useful tool in that respect to offload certain functions that just, they take time and there's no reason for a human to try and crunch data, for example? And then is there anything that's really lost? How do you, it's not that it's lost. The thing I guess that I would be concerned about being lost is the ability of the person to check that data, check the result that comes out of an AI. Because when you're dealing with things that are increasingly subjective, perhaps, as opposed to a simple mathematical 2 + 2 = 4 every single time, how do you get trustworthiness on a more subjective analysis? Because it's going to be the algorithm, whether it's Netflix or something developed the DoD, that takes the data and says, "This is based on this behavior, we predict this." You got to have a way to have a sanity check to make sure the AI is giving you what you want.
Yes, I love that insight. And compared to a calculator comment, you know, what you're talking about as far as the calculator giving you back the correct answer that you know is correct, that is very much the form of predictability, right? If it gives you something that is unpredictable, that lessens your willingness to work with that calculator. And that's why I think focusing on that predictability can be really important. The other thing I'll say is you kind of strike a nerve of this whole debate with we're shifting from these concepts of tools, which are very deterministic in nature. So that calculator, you know, it hasn't undergone machine learning and deep learning where it can have infinite number of possible outputs. It's a tool and it's deterministic. But one of the things that is a bit unnerving for folks about teaming with AI specifically is that it has non-deterministic outputs based on how it was trained. So who trained it and what data was it trained on? What's the provenance of the data? a lot of those questions need to be answered so that we're able to have, you know, meet some of those NIST standards as far as having that reliability and explainability.
Because that would seem to be one of the vulnerabilities there is the data, the two pieces you mentioned, but the fundamental one is the data set. If you have a data set that has been edited and some things are left out because whatever it presents a potential for bias that the, I'll use the term programmer, doesn't want, or, you know, the outcome is going to lead in a direction that's not what's desired, you could trim and prune the data set. But that's going to get, that's like, again, to use mathematical analogies, that's not, it's not as though you can take the multiplication table that you learn in maybe what, third or fourth grade from, you know, 1 to 9. It says, well, I don't like the row with sevens in it. Let's just take that out. You got to have the full multiplication table as your foundation for doing math. You can't, if you have an edited one and there are gaps, the results you're going to get are going to be flawed. It may be evident if you're dealing with math. If you're doing something that's more in the conceptual or even cognitive space for the human actor, that's a blind spot, right?
Yes, absolutely. And another good example of this is just, you know, what's another example of a tool that's common to Air Force operations? It's the Auto Ground Collision Avoidance System, AutoGCAS. That's a deterministic system because it has certain inputs. And then based on, you know, once you get to that point where you're likely to collide with the ground, that is going to execute a pull-up maneuver without the pilot's input, unless the pilot just has the system turned off, right? Which, Jared, do you know how long it took us to operationalize that system and get it, like, truly accepted as far as a new technology?
To where they would trust it? No, I don't.
It was over a decade.
A decade.
So that's an example of, you know, how this story as far as our ability to accept the technology can go faster or slower based on the messaging around it, you know, how the design and development is transparent to the operator and how much involvement those operators have with that design process.
Interesting. So I think you mentioned there were another couple of ideas or models that you were working with that you could use as examples. What would be the second of those?
Yes. So the second one is actually that human to deterministic tool. So often folks come to the table with this idea that AI is only going to do those deterministic end states. Once they realize that there's an infinite number, essentially based on how it was trained, and to your discussion about the data sets, perhaps it's not any malicious intent or bias as far as changing the data set, but perhaps the collection of a data set hasn't been sufficient or hasn't been done over time for enough time for us to have a very robust data set, which is something that we're kind of struggling with right now. So if this mental model of human deterministic tool is brought, then the AI agent is merely a tool with no need to design for teaming, right? So that kind of makes it so we no longer see the need to team with it because it's going to do what it's going to do. In this case, the fear is I want to control it and not share any type of interdependencies, which really drives a wedge between our idea of shifting to a more mission type orders command paradigm from the way that we've, you know, controlled aircraft in the past for, let's say, our collaborative combat aircraft example as a case study. The last mental model, we hit on it a little bit previously, is a human to an invisible AI agent. So from the Netflix example, if the assumption here is there is no AI providing this convenience or this service, oftentimes folks are surprised when you tell them that every single day they're interacting and using AI in some form or fashion. The fear here is that I can live my life without using AI. With an applied, I cannot. The fact that it's so invisible trains us and develops that habit of we don't need to team with it. It's just operating in the background and providing these personalized conveniences, which is not how we want to team with it operationally.
Right, because it's excluding some things. It's based on what has happened in the past in its data set. It's queuing up what it thinks you're going to want, as you mentioned, the Netflix model, to see this in the afternoon or the evening. Whereas, to bring this back in the realm of national security, one of the fundamental mistakes, and I have heard this, I don't know who originated the comment, one of the basic problems you have in planning in international security is assuming that tomorrow is going to look like today or yesterday. And that will mess you up on the day that things change fundamentally, because that's when, that's your bad day. When somebody decides to do something that we were not expecting them to do because they didn't do it yesterday, the day before, last week, or they've never done. You know, when something really innovative and disruptive happens, then if your model was based on what's been happening the last few days, you're toast. So that background curating model, where invisible, as you said, as a term of art, builds a good data set to try and predict your viewing preferences. But it's not good for trying to predict how tomorrow is going to be, today or tomorrow is going to be different from those previous days. That would seem to be the place where you really want to have this human AI teaming model to work on what data is coming in right now and start to identify where the deltas are from yesterday to say, you know, your adversary might be doing something different today, expect a surprise, and then, you know, use that new batch of sensor data to try and help the human decision maker figure out with the AI, what am I seeing here? Because this is different from tomorrow. So that's a shift, right? That's not, let's figure out your similarities, but to figure out what your differences are, and now let's hone in on those. Is that an ongoing focus of research, to look more at the identification of differences or indications of warning that we can talk about in an unclassified environment, of course?
Yes. So being an Intel officer and an analyst at heart, there's so many applications for human agent teaming. And I've seen several of them actually, you know, in working various jobs where we successfully incorporated AI as a teammate to help us do analysis faster and, you know, inform the warfighter sooner, cut some of those timelines down. Oftentimes Intel is just drowning in data. There's far too much data for analysts to get through, even if you have, say, 100 analysts on the ops floor. They're just not going to get through the data. So that's where AI can run over it and identify trends, identify anomalies. The other thing, there's a lab at University of Maryland called the Applied Research Lab for Intelligence and Security, or ARLIS. They've done a good bit of work to identify, okay, if we have this data from open source and this data from the various sensors we have out there, where are the gaps in the data that we need to solve a specific problem? So that's an example of, you know, humans aren't very good at identifying what we don't know. So often with Intel work, it's what you don't know that gets you versus what you do know. So AI as a teammate could really help fill some of those gaps of helping us see what we're missing and what we don't know, or where we should be collecting within a data set to solve a specific problem.
Well, I think you've done a good job of describing the outlining, shall we say, the AI side of it and the need for good data sets and such. What would you say we need to do thinking ahead? And you may not necessarily be prepared for this question, but you work with cadets, so you probably are. How do we train the next generation of the human side of that equation to give them the right mindset to know what to expect from the AI and what to also need to watch out for with the AI? Because you've got a group that you said before, you've got students that are growing up with this now, so they're comfortable with it in the background. They think they're known by the AI. But is there a danger of too much familiarity and too assumptions that that's just natural? Do we need to, you know, maintain a certain critical thinking component to, and skepticism, I guess, to what the AI is producing in some way? And how do you do that with a generation that becomes increasingly confident with the AI in the loop so they don't become too complacent? Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. And that's a really interesting thing about this topic, is the vast responses and the dispersion kind of specific questions about the topic of human agent teaming. I find that cadets are far more curious and really want to dive in and work with, you know, these autonomous systems and try to figure it out, what's going on. Sometimes they're over-trusting, if you will. And that's something that DARPA study is actually looking at in partnership with Iowa University. Their Air Combat Evolution, also known as DARPA-ACE, there's a report, a white paper that they wrote, developing a trust-o-meter, where they looked at both under trust and over trust of an AI agent assisting the pilot in the cockpit. So there is that concern, you know, that certain generations are going to be far too accepting of AI. And this is where, if we do it well and we prioritize this human agent teaming piece, we can design these so that they meet requirements of things like bidirectional communication. You have to establish those task interdependencies, and then that helps you delineate roles and responsibilities once you get into that execution phase. There has to be some ability to sense the actions of the other teammates, whether that is a human, or oftentimes, since these are so narrowly scoped AI-enabled agents, it's going to be a team of those agents doing specific tasks based on what they were trained to do. And then the last is just understanding the disparate strengths and weaknesses across the teammates that you're bringing to bear on a specific problem. If these, you know, if we develop a framework, I'm not saying this is the end all be all framework, but we need some type of framework to provide commonality across what is the actual mental model we're designing from, so that we're not all coming to the table with different expectations and the vague terms like trustworthiness, right? What are the stepping stones to get to trustworthiness? So to answer the other part of your question, what can we do as far as giving cadets these experiences? One of the things I'm investigating is actually, what are other systems or experiences that we could team cadets with to act as a bridge of sorts, to expose them to some of these teaming dynamics that are different than the mental models they may already have developed. And what I did was actually team cadets with horses, because I found that horses meet most of the criteria that I just talked through as far as human agent teaming. So that you have to have that bidirectional communication, and it's nonverbal predominantly. So how do you learn a different language? And then how do you apply that language, for example?
Would you expand a little bit on the horse model? I mean, I've heard pieces of this over the year. How do you view the horse as an analog here in this process of learning how to work with an AI? You know, the horse is communicating non-verbally, you know, non-linguistically, but the horse has, you know, it's its own sensor suite, as you would say. Expand on that a little bit, because that's fascinating.
Yes. Yeah, so most of the folks designing these AI systems today, the sensors and that integration of the sensor suite is a big challenge, and understandably so. If you think of, you know, self-driving cars and all the different sensors that are on there, how do you integrate so that you're providing one data stream to make decisions from? The horse gives the user the experience of an exquisite set of sensors that maybe in the future will be able to actually have a lot of those underlying enabling technologies be mature enough to provide that exquisite of a sensor suite. So instead of waiting for this technology to mature, we can provide these bridge type of experiences to cadets, where the way the program flowed forward was, first the cadets observed the horses interacting in a herd and tried to understand and decipher those nonverbal cues across the horses. So what are their ears doing? What does that movement signify? How are they holding their eyes? How do they move together? And then the second step was actually being able to predict, working one-on-one with a specific horse of, you know, if I ask this horse to walk forward, what is the cue for that horse to walk forward? And then we increased the complexity of the task until the cadets felt confident that they were able to cue the horse to accomplish about 15 different types of tasks. And then the last step is that directability. So then the cadets got to team with another human horse partner and accomplish an obstacle course together based on selecting the obstacles they felt their horse was best at. So that's where we're incorporating the understanding the difference in strengths and weaknesses between a human and a horse, and then also between the human horse teams, and then making a decision to best place each of those to accomplish an obstacle course, with the cadets applying all those cues that they just tested out to direct the horse.
I imagine the cadets appreciate this experience. So again, a chance to get out of the cadet area over to the stables, which that's still on the south side of the academy base area, right?
Yes. Yeah. We were able to use the academy stables and even the academy dude horses that often are just used for trail rides. So it was a fun experience for everyone, and provided, right, underlying, if we go back to the mental models, it provided the cadets a different mental model to work from than the other ones that we previously discussed.
One of the founding members of the political science department, one of the first faculty, was Lieutenant Colonel Julian Bradbury. He was an avid horseman, had a ranch over in Woodland Park, and spent a lot of time with the equestrian program in the academy. He would have loved to have heard about this program and connected it with current policy and security. So you're doing work that has a long legacy, I think, there at the academy, and hopefully continue to do that now and then, hopefully when you return to or after you do your PhD. One last question, then I'll ask you the question to sort of wrap this up here. But I know we talked before, I'm not going to put you on the hook to characterize American industry and where we are in partnering with government, which has been somewhat contentious over the years with regard to AI and different companies and teaming. But often it is said that in the scaremongering of what's going on in the world, that the Chinese are ahead of us in AI, and if we don't change X, Y, or Z, we'll fall behind. What you've said about the data sets and how you get people to partner and kind of things would suggest to me, and I think I've heard this in other discussions, so I'm not claiming this is my analysis, but it would seem that a closed authoritarian system like China would have significant problems developing an AI, because they're going to want to limit the data it's going to work with, and they're going to want to limit the outcomes. So maybe they can do that in a purely military security context, but I don't think there's going to be a Chinese version of ChatGPT quite like what we have experimenting with in the U.S., because it's not going to be allowed to disagree with Xi Jinping. So the compulsion to modify the data for a political outcome would seem to cripple a Chinese effort. Maybe not in the purely military security side if they're just trying to adapt this for a weapon, but in an overall sense of research, it would seem like a closed authoritarian system actually has a disadvantage in this space. Is that a reasonable assumption, or am I introducing my own bias there?
I think it's a very reasonable assumption. I think the challenges that China identified that limitation probably about 10 years ago, as far as needing to have vast amounts of data. I don't recall the exact report, but it was referring to data as the new oil, as far as a currency. And that was out at least, you know, I think it was 2017, 2018 timeframe with that focus. And China's done a huge effort to create large data sets to train a lot of these different AI agents across. Not going to talk to any specific one, but they kind of called that as, okay, you know, if we are limited because we have this control of the information flow, how do we get ahead of this and really collect robust data from the data that we could collect, essentially, was the question that it seemed like they were trying to answer. So I think things like ChatGPT, you know, those are always going to be limited because of they don't have freedom of speech, right? And the data they're going to be able to pull from to run that is not going to be robust. But I think it's a very closed-minded perspective. I would say that ChatGPT is something that is high priority to China as far as their development of robust AI. And I would assume that they're doing a pretty comprehensive job of collecting data. If we think of, you know, the citizen scores that they have and the social credit scores within China and how much data must go into that and the ability for algorithms to run over all that data in real time. A lot of their traffic systems are set up based on traffic flows at a specific hour of the day, and it's all timed and it's all algorithm backed, you know. So if they're doing these robust logistics and just tracking of their population, what does that enable for military use as far as that algorithmic development?
Well, based on the explanation, I think I'm thinking back to your earlier discussion of the human agent teaming. I would probably retract some of my skepticism about their development, which is purely based on reading the news. I'm not plugged into the broader discussions of this, but they have optimized for their own needs how they're using the AI agent for their own purposes. And even though they may have limitations on what they would do in one sphere, with regard to the language models, they're not going to worry about that. If they can use it to sort data to optimize their social credit score system or anything else domestically they want to use for control purposes, that tool set will probably do for them what they expect and want it to do. And they may just have a, you know, internal model, and they'll develop tools that they'll only deploy externally. And I think we're not without our own blind spots, because clearly in the news the last couple of weeks, different companies have, you know, argued that AI violates intellectual property. So while it might not, you know, violate Xi Jinping thought in the U.S., but well, it violates intellectual property. So you can't have AI designing posters in a particular style, and therefore that's going to be curbed. So I think our two respective models of governance and society have their own ways that we're shaping this and limiting it. So it'll be a continuing competitive challenge. So we can continue. Go ahead.
Oh, it's such a complex topic. I think you can argue any side of it.
Yeah, and we could keep going on again and again, but you know, maybe we'll pick this up in a separate discussion at some other point in the future. But for now, to keep this within the traditional bounds, I'll thank you and then unleash the question that I typically pose to everybody. In the next 5 years, what change or trend in international or domestic politics, economics, law, technology, or culture will have the greatest impact on national security, in your opinion? Now, you can continue and say, you know, AI and the things you're working on now, or you're free to go in any other direction. So what do you think?
I honestly believe that the ability to access the materials, the raw earth materials for semiconductors, and just to be able to have the computing power on a small scale, right, that's going to enable a lot of the AI. So it's tied to AI. Again, I can't completely disregard AI. It is a powerful technology, but I think it gets down into how do we look at understanding where these materials are coming from, who's doing a lot of the manufacturing of that very micro compute power that's going to be fundamental. If you think of over COVID, when the cars, right, there were car shortages as far as there weren't as many cars being manufactured because of the semiconductor shortage. That could happen at a much broader scale as well.
Yeah, the semiconductor shortage was just because fabrication of semiconductors using traditional, you know, silicon-based wafers and stuff. That was a supply chain thing that was based on a fairly commonly available resource, as opposed to what you talked about there, less common rare earth minerals that then go into producing things. Okay, well, thank you for that thought. And thank everybody for listening to this 9th episode of the N3SP podcast. We hope you've enjoyed hearing about national security and implications for artificial intelligence, which actually go beyond artificial intelligence, as Melissa was talking about, everything from AI, it's shaping your Netflix queue or the news you may read that appears on a browser screen or in some application you have on a smartphone, all is curated by some form of algorithm, which has been the focus of part of her research and will be in the future. So thank you again, Melissa, and I hope folks will stay tuned for future episodes. In the meantime, if they'd like any more information about the partnership, please go to our website, n3sp.org. Goodbye.
Bye.